So we come this evening to the 10th chapter in the Life Divine. Conscious Force, a translation of a Sanskrit term, Chit Shakti. Chit meaning consciousness, and Shakti meaning power or force. We have two mottos, citations from Vedantic works that open the chapter, selected by Sri Aurobindo and translated by him. They beheld the self-force of the divine being, deep hidden by its own conscious modes of working. From the Shvetashvatara Upanishad 1.3. Shvetashvatara, by the way, means the white-horsed one. The next says, this is he that is awake in those who sleep. From the Katha Upanishad, Katha means story. This is the one with the story about Yama and Nachiketas, whom you'll remember from our study recently. If we look a little more closely at the citations, the first one says, actually, those who practice dhyana yoga, they who practice dhyana yoga beheld the atma shakti of the deva hidden by the gunas. So it is again the power of a yogic sight, the capacity to see into and behind appearances, behind the working of nature. It permits you to view the penetralia of existence. It is that power of insight that the yogin possesses, which reveals reality. The Upanishads, of course, put far more emphasis on the nature of this kind of experience, this mystical experience, than on the logical pretensions of the mind. The second in Sanskrit is Ya Esha Supteshu Jagarti. Awake in those who sleep. So conscious, even in a state of apparent unconsciousness, is this being. He is awake, even when things seem to be slumbering. So then we're led to redefine what means consciousness. We'll see that in the second half of this chapter. Conscious force, predicated upon the pure existent. Sri Aurobindo in the last chapter said that the pure existent is a fact. It is a fundamental reality. However we may conceive of that which is unknowable and beyond the oppositions and the contraries of reason, whatever that might be, it posits itself as pure being, sheer existence, sat. And upon that sat, all this is manifested. Everything that moves is drawn from the reality of that existence and partakes of it. So we're looking not at a vain series of epiphenomena, but we're looking at a phenomenal flow which is based upon real being. This universe that confronts our senses is a genuine representation of that to which we can give no name. All names and figurations fall short of capturing it in its entirety, in its vastness, and in its transcendence. So it is. That is what we begin with. It is. And if you're here, you are. But now, conscious force. And it's interesting, he deals first with force. It comes from a Latin word, by the way, meaning strength. The Latin is fortis. And in its first applications in Western thought, it spoke to that power which would permeate all space and be capable of impinging itself upon objects and bodies distant to it, like gravity. It's the law. So let's begin. All phenomenal existence resolves itself into force, into a movement of energy that assumes more or less material, more or less gross or subtle forms for self-presentation to its own experience. For self, presentation to its own experience. So existence manifests a universe for its own reasons. It serves itself. In the ancient images by which human thought attempted to make this origin and law of being intelligible and real to itself, this infinite existence of force was figured as a sea, initially at rest, and therefore free from forms, but the first disturbance, the first initiation of movement, necessitates the creation of forms and is the seed of a universe. This is an image which is mythological, metaphorical, powerful. It moves us even as we consider it today. And it's interesting, I think, that modern physics turns to language like this when it wants to express the big picture. What is that primordial pre-existence from which this universe comes? What is it that tickles it into motion? Why should it suddenly manifest and expand? Going back to that initial sentence, all phenomenal existence resolves itself into force. So, very akin to Einstein's E equals mc squared. All things are reducible to this energy, boundless energy, which figures itself in material form. From an ocean, a samudra, the Rig Veda often speaks of this ocean of existence. So we move on to the second paragraph then. Matter is the presentation of force which is most easily intelligible to our intelligence, molded as it is by contacts in matter, to which a mind involved in material brain gives the response. Well, the physicist might say there is only the realm of matter. Sri Aurobindo here suggests, implies, that matter is the most reachable expression of force, not the only. He will consider other planes of existence. But given the fact that our mentality is so obscured and really based in materiality, the first thing that we see when we regard the universe is that. The mystic may be aware of a deeper, a profounder aspect of reality, but in our common view, we open our eyes and we see the material world, and our brain and thinking centers around that. So let's consider that. The elementary state of material force is, in the view of the old Indian physicists, a condition of pure material extension in space, of which the peculiar property is vibration, typified to us by the phenomenon of sound. The extension in space. Space to these ancient Indian thinkers was akasha, which we translate roughly as ether. The vibration is what we know in the Tantra as spanda, shabda. And, well, the vibration is spanda and the sound is shabda. So he's making an early equation here, or let us say, throwing a grappling hook upon the edifice, both of the Sankhya philosophy and the Tantric philosophy, to express what matter comes from. So the first thing that he's saying is that akasha leads. A condition of pure material extension in space. But he goes on, but vibration in this state of ether is not sufficient to create forms. So the ocean of existence that might be there cannot really fashion itself into a varied universe, a multi-formal universe, until, and he goes on to say, there must first be some obstruction in the flow of the force ocean, some contraction and expansion, some interplay of vibrations, some impinging of force upon force, so as to create a beginning of fixed relations and mutual effects. Going back to the inability of modern physics to explain why there would be this singularity that leads to the expansion of a universe, you can see even the mystic looking at this sees that something must perturb that ocean of milk. Something must arise within it. Force must meet force. There has to be some obstruction, some obscurity that engenders differentiation. Otherwise, it remains homogeneous, no? So, material force modifying its first ethereal status assumes a second, called in the old language the aerial, of which the special property is contact between force and force, contact that is the basis of all material relations. So we have akasha, which is expressing itself as sound. Shabda, ether expresses itself as sound. But ether derives from itself the principle of air, vayu, which goes out and makes contact with things. That contact is called sparsha. Still, he continues, we have not as yet real forms, but only varying forces. So there's a confluence, you might say, of forces arising within this ocean. So perhaps you can image them as rivers which are meeting, and when they meet, you have convulsive activity. So we don't have forms, we have only these forces pushing against each other. A sustaining principle is needed. Ah, we have to get to forms, don't we? We have to get to shapes. And then, and then when we get to shapes, we'll eventually name them. This is provided by a third self-modification of the primitive force, of which the principle of light, electricity, fire, and heat is for us the characteristic manifestation. The heat is tejas, what is brilliant. And that is what takes this ether and air and conflict of forces and fashions them into distinguishable shapes, rupa. Even then, he says, we can have forms of force preserving their own character and peculiar action, but not stable forms of matter. So, they may come, but they go. We have somehow to sustain them. So a fourth state, he writes, characterized by diffusion and a first medium of permanent attractions and repulsions, termed picturesquely water or the liquid state, and a fifth of cohesion, termed earth or the solid state, complete the necessary elements. Well, the fourth is up, which we translate as water. And that thing which attracts and repels is rasa. So there's a taste we like or we don't like. So we have this descending manifestation reaching towards a final material basis, and all we need now is something to solidify it, and that is what earth does. And earth is prithivi. And what is its thing? Gandha, which is taste. Rasa may be the quality of appreciation, but actually it is gandha which tastes it. So all these five are necessary, and what we have are the common elements of ancient philosophy in the West as well. So it seems to be an Indo-Aryan conception of the world that we have ether and air and fire and water and earth that go into the constitution of this world. So this is how we get to matter. By descent. So what he is drawing here is a picture of the elemental forces of the world, but not in terms of chemistry, but in terms of metaphysics. We have to make a distinction between what chemistry arrives at, which is in the gross world, and what Sri Aurobindo is talking about here, most of it behind in potency and actualizing itself in process, and then finally eventuates in what we would call the chemical composition of the universe. So let us go forward then. All forms of matter of which we are aware, all physical things, even to the most subtle, are built up by the combination of these five elements. Upon them also depends all our sensible experience, for by reception of vibration comes the sense of sound, by contact of things in the world of vibrations of force, the sense of touch, by the action of light in the forms hatched, outlined, sustained by the force of light and fire and heat, the sense of sight, by the fourth element, the sense of taste, by the fifth, the sense of smell. I made an error earlier, and I apologize for that. All is essentially response to vibratory contacts between force and force. In this way, the ancient thinkers bridged the gulf between pure force and its final modifications and satisfied the difficulty which prevents the ordinary human mind from understanding how all these forms, which are to his senses so real, solid, and durable, can be in truth only temporary phenomena and a thing like pure energy to the senses non-existent, intangible, and almost incredible, can be the one permanent cosmic reality. All things in the universe reducible to this energy. Shabda, sparsha, rupa, rasa, gandha. Note that he has invoked sound first. Shabda is first in the manifestation of the world. The primacy of the creative word, Brahman, in its many senses, and you can do the rest. So on to the next paragraph. The problem of consciousness is not solved by this theory, for it does not explain how the contact of vibrations of force should give rise to conscious sensations. The Sankhyas, or analytic thinkers, posited therefore behind these five elements two principles which they called Mahat and Ahankara, principles which are really non-material. For the first is nothing but the vast cosmic principle of force, and the other, the divisional principle of ego formation. Mahat is a Sanskrit word which means the great, the vast, and Ahankara means I maker. He continues, nevertheless, these two principles, as also the principle of intelligence, become active in consciousness not by virtue of force itself, but by virtue of an inactive conscious soul or souls in which its activities are reflected, and by that reflection assume the hue of consciousness. This is that division that Sankhya makes between the play of nature and all its phenomena and the conscious witness spirit, the real person, the Purusha. The play is Prakriti, the person is Purusha. And the person looking at the world discovers that ultimately the substratum of consciousness has nothing to do with any of it, is distinguishable from the profoundest thought, the deepest emotion, all the flurries of activity on the surface, the rain, the earthquake, the grass growing beneath the feet, all of these things are simply the phenomena of nature. And the Purusha simply watches. When it pulls back into itself, it is separate from all of this. And so, when it regards nature, nature reflects its innate consciousness, but does not possess it itself. So to the Sankhya, consciousness is outside of nature is not part of the cosmos. This is not a perspective that Sri Aurobindo accepts or shares. Onwards, such is the explanation of things offered by the school of Indian philosophy, which comes nearest to the modern materialistic ideas, and which carried the idea of a mechanical or unconscious force in nature as far as was possible to a seriously reflective Indian mind. Whatever its defects, its main idea was so indisputable that it came to be generally accepted. And we've spoken about this before, but let's say it again. The Sankhyan philosophy, which has its roots in the original insights of a sage named Kapila, the Red One, is pre-Aryan. This goes back before the Vedic civilization was already part of Indian wisdom about the time that the Vedas were being written. Ironically, all the terminology that subsequent philosophy uses in India, by and large, comes from this Sankhyan school. So it has influenced Indian thinking up to this day. We see Sri Aurobindo using this language to explain fundamentally Vedantic insights. And Vedanta is based upon the unity of experience and not upon the division of experience. Back to Kapila for a moment. The genius of his insight is that the soul is free of all of this, and we can live absolutely in the spirit of our nature and not be bothered by any of the play of phenomena. Later, the Buddha, who grew up in Kapilavastu, that is the land of Kapila, takes that insight, which is native to his land, and it becomes the core principle of his own psychology. So Kapila might properly be called India's first psychologist. Buddha, perhaps its greatest. In ancient times. So, I think we got to the middle of the paragraph. However, the phenomenon of consciousness may be explained, whether nature be an inert impulse or a conscious principle, it is certainly force. The principle of things is a formative movement of energies. All forms are born of meeting and mutual adaptation between unshaped forces. All sensation and action is a response of something in a form of force to the contacts of other forms of force. This is the world as we experience it, and from this experience we must always start. So he accepts that force is a reality. He's already posited existence as being real, and force is an expression of it. So, now things begin to become a little more interesting to those of us who care about the inner dimensions of things. Physical analysis of matter by modern science has come to the same general conclusion, even if a few last doubts still linger. Intuition and experience confirm this concord of science and philosophy. So again, Sri Aurobindo asserts that intuition is a greater arbiter of the truth than reason. Pure reason, he says, finds in it the satisfaction of its own essential conceptions. For even in the view of the world as essentially an act of consciousness, an act is implied, and in the act, movement of force, play of energy. This also, when we examine from within our own experience, proves to be the fundamental nature of the world. All our activities are the play of the triple force of the old philosophies: knowledge force, desire force, action force. And all these prove to be really three streams of one original and identical power, Adya Shakti. Even our states of rest are only equable state or equilibrium of the play of her movement. So this movement is constant, and this play is inescapable. If there are periods of rest, there are moments of pause, and then the movement continues. Movement of force, being admitted as the whole nature of the cosmos, two questions arise. And first, how did this movement come to take place at all in the bosom of existence? If we suppose it to be not only eternal, but the very essence of all existence, the question does not arise. But we have negatived this theory. We are aware of an existence which is not compelled by the movement. How then does this movement, alien to its eternal repose, come to take place in it? By what cause? By what possibility? By what mysterious impulsion? This is a processive view of the universe. And again, he notes in here that we are aware of an existence which is not compelled by the movement. In other words, again, yogic knowledge trumps reason. We are not aware of it through the process of analysis, deduction. We are aware of it by direct sight. He writes, the answer most approved by the ancient Indian mind was that force is inherent in existence. Shiva and Kali, Brahman and Shakti, are one and not two who are separable. So again, all this is part of a unified reality. Shiva, the auspicious, benign sovereign who watches all things from his mountain fastnesses. Kali, involved in the whirl of existence. Brahman, that indefinable, absolute. Shakti, the energy, conscious, moving, going forward, are the same thing. Force is part of existence. It is the same thing as existence. Force inherent in existence may be at rest or it may be in motion, but when it is at rest, it exists nonetheless and is not abolished, diminished, or in any way essentially altered. Sri Aurobindo has a sentence, a line in Savitri, in absolute silence is an absolute power. Or perhaps it is, in absolute silence sleeps an absolute power. This reply is so entirely rational and in accordance with the nature of things that we need not hesitate to accept it. For it is impossible, because contradictory of reason, to suppose that force is a thing alien to the one and infinite existence, and entered into it from outside, or was non-existent and arose in it at some point in time. So force, in other words, must be part of the very nature of existence. It can't come in from outside because only existence exists, yes? And it can't simply arise at some point in time. It is not a thing that is created. It is a thing that creates, necessarily. So it must exist in some sense within existence before manifestation can occur. Even the illusionist theory must admit that Maya, the power of self-illusion in Brahman, is potentially eternal in eternal being. And then the sole question is its manifestation or non-manifestation. He's got him there because this is actually a statement. Remember, Sri Aurobindo had studied Advaita Vedanta and Shankara pretty closely. He did not have a lot of Indian philosophy present in his study. His library was limited. It's too bad that he didn't have the works of Kashmir Shaivism, the Shiva Sutras and things like that. He would have found that they wonderfully dovetailed with his philosophy. On the other hand, perhaps it's good that he didn't, because then he could look into the nature of reality and express philosophically what he saw without having to revert constantly to other and earlier forms of Indian thought. It's enough that he had to deal with Sankhya anymore. perhaps the terminology would have been too complex to wrestle with. We can go back and compare them. But this unity of consciousness with the activity of nature is a cardinal insight recorded in the Shiva Sutras. In fact, the opening verse of the Shiva Sutras is Chaitanyam Atma. Consciousness and conscious force, by association, is the self. It is the very nature of the self. And only the self, the Atman, really exists. So again, it's cognate with the idea of the Atma Shakti, which we saw in the first citation. So the Shiva Sutras are very much comparable to this idea. So, I think let's move to the final sentence in this paragraph. The Sankhya also asserts the eternal coexistence of Prakriti and Purusha, nature and conscious soul, and the alternative states of rest or equilibrium of Prakriti and movement or disturbance of equilibrium. So, in other words, the Indian traditions concur. Even though Advaita Vedanta does not want to accept that the universe is real, it accepts that the power of Maya is implied as a part of Brahman. It must be, because where could it come from if not? And the covalence of Purusha and Prakriti in some sort of balance, one implying the relationship always to the other, is part of the Sankhya view. So you may like to quit, but we're going forward another paragraph. But since force is thus inherent in existence, and it is the nature of force to have this double or alternative potentiality of rest and movement, that is to say, of self-concentration in force and self-diffusion in force, the question of the how of the movements, its possibility, initiating impulsion or impelling cause, does not arise. For we can easily then conceive that this potentiality must translate itself either as an alternative rhythm of rest and movement succeeding each other in time, or else as an eternal self-concentration of force in immutable existence, with a superficial play of movement, change, and formation, like the rising and falling of waves on the surface of the ocean. And this superficial play, we are necessarily speaking in inadequate images, may be either coeval with the self-concentration and itself also eternal, or it may begin and end in time and be resumed in a sort of constant rhythm. It is then not eternal in continuity, it is then not eternal in continuity, but eternal in recurrence. He has not taken a position. He's leaving that as a selection not made right now. But again, you can view physics in this light, the steady state idea that the universe always exists, there was no beginning, there is no end, or the Big Bang theory, which is that there was an initiation, an expansion, and then, of course, there was the idea that there would be a falling back, and so a continuation of creation and dissolution of universe after universe after universe, which would tie in with one Indian cosmology of ancient mint, that these were the breaths of Brahma, that he would breathe out a universe and breathe it back in again and again. By the way, the term coeval means of the same age. So, in other words, this expansion and contraction could all exist within Brahman or be successive. The idea of eternal recurrence, of course, is something that is taken up and discussed, I think, by Eliade and maybe even Uspensky. If you have time, you might care to take a look. On to the next paragraph. The problem of the how, thus eliminated, there presents itself the question of the why. Why should this possibility of a play of movement of force translate itself at all? Why should not force of existence remain eternally concentrated in itself, infinite, free from all variation and formation? So, is there something to cause this existence to release its force into action? Why can't it simply be inside all the time? What stirs it to act? This question also does not arise if we assume existence to be non-conscious and consciousness only a development of material energy, which we wrongly suppose to be immaterial. This is back to the Sankhian view of things, a materialistic view shared by the Charvaka philosophy in ancient India. For then we can say simply that this rhythm is the nature of force in existence, and there is absolutely no reason to seek for a why, a cause, an initial motive, or a final purpose for that which is in its nature eternally self-existent. Because nothing existed it, right? It was a steady state. It's always present. We cannot put that question to eternal self-existence and ask it either why it exists or how it came into existence. Neither can we put it to self-force of existence and its inherent nature of impulsion to movement. All that we can then inquire into is its manner of self-manifestation, its principles of movement and formation, its process of evolution. And this is precisely what science would inquire into and define. Both existence and force being inert, inert status and inert impulsion, both of them unconscious and unintelligent, There cannot be any purpose or final goal in evolution or any original cause or intention. This is not his position. This is not Sri Aurobindo's position, because he has a larger picture of what consciousness is. As you can see in the next sentence, but if we suppose or find existence to be conscious being, the problem arises. Well, we'll save that problem for next week. We'll complete this chapter next time, because we've dealt with force, and now we're going to deal with consciousness. That's the fun part. There's no reason not to keep that entire. Why should we fragment this? Let's observe the rhythm within the chapter and call this a good breaking point. So, any confusions we can clear up now? Add any clarity? Any questions to ask? Very good. Then we'll go for our meditation. Jai Ma. Namaste. Namaste.